Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And we start with domestic political news for the good martini. This comes from the latest Quinnipiac poll, specifically in the state of Colorado. And if you look at the electoral vote set up for 2016, Colorado could end up being a very important state if Republicans are going to win back the White House. And according to the latest numbers from the Centennial State, Republicans appear to be poised to do just that. Obviously, we're almost still a year away from Election Day, but according to the poll, Marco Rubio leads Hillary Clinton 52-36. Ben Carson leads her 52-38. Ted Cruz is ahead of her 51-38. And Donald Trump beats Hillary Clinton 48-37%. There's also evidence showing that all of them would beat Bernie Sanders, but it's actually closer in most of those cases. Also, when it comes to honest and trustworthy, 67% say Hillary is not, only 30% say she is, and her negativity rating, 33% like her, 61% don't. Jim, with somebody who's as well-known as Hillary Clinton, those are hard numbers to change.
They are. We should not act like we've got Colorado in the bag in 2016. Obviously, it's early. We've seen the polls in the gubernatorial races really far off this year. So, you know, you don't want to put too much stock in them. But this is not an insignificant drop. You look at a number like, you know, Rubio above her, 52% to 36%. That's not even close. For those of us who are, you know, reasonably optimistic about Marco Rubio, that contrast looks really good. The face of the future versus the face of the past. Or to quote her in the debate, Greg, I come from the 60s, earthlings, a mere 5 decades ago. Ben Carson, same numbers. You know, Donald Trump, right? The horrible, unelectable Donald Trump is only up 11. You know, I like the description of it, a chilly, if not frigid, reception in Colorado for Clinton. You know, it is winter, Greg, so maybe that's what we should expect. No, look, again, don't act like we got this wrapped up, but, you know, I also can't help but get the feeling that, look, you know, trying to check out when these poll was conducted, we are turning back towards the issues of foreign policy and national security. And I don't think that's really the big strength for Hillary Clinton that her people seem to think it is. I think she's got Benghazi stuck to her like glue, and there's really not much reason to think that her judgment has gotten that much better. Now, the open question is, how much is she going to defend the performance of this president as Americans feel less and less safe? So only one poll. There's a lot of road before us before there's Election Day 2016, but some optimistic numbers here for Republicans and some very ominous numbers here for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, definitely the case, and she's got a lot of work to do if she's going to make up ground there, and let's hope she can't do it. Okay, on to the bad martini now. And Jim, over the past couple of days, the president has made some bizarre statements. Just even if you agree with his position, they seem almost antagonistic and tone deaf in how he's mocking Republicans while on foreign soil about their concerns that ISIS members could slip in with the mass of refugees from the Middle East trying to get into our country. Here's a quick example of that.
These are the same folks oftentimes who suggest that they're so tough that just talking to Putin or staring down ISIL or using some additional rhetoric somehow is going to solve the problems out there. But apparently they're scared of widows and orphans coming into the United States of America as part of our tradition of compassion. You know, first they were worried about the press being too tough on them during debates. Now they're worried about three-year-old orphans.
Three-year-old orphans. Well, let's just take a look at what's happened over the past 24 hours here. This one from Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit. 5 Syrians with stolen Greek passports tried to enter the United States from Honduras. The Syrian men were held in Honduras after their arrival from Costa Rica. The men had traveled by air from Syria to Lebanon, then to Turkey, Brazil, Argentina, Costa Rica, and on to Honduras. And now it appears a 6th man with a similar bogus passport has also been arrested in Honduras. Not to be outdone, Turkish police detained 8 suspected members of the Islamic State jihadist group, according to Yahoo, through state media in Turkey, adding that they were planning to sneak into Europe posing as refugees. Also, Breitbart, 2 federal agents operating under the umbrella of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, are claiming that 8 Syrian illegal aliens attempted to enter Texas from Mexico in the Laredo sector, although I don't see a mention that they're posing necessarily as refugees. But, Jim, the idea that all of this is just fear-mongering on the part of the right, given ISIS's stated intent to infiltrate the refugees, seems to be blowing up in the president's face here.
Well, here's an observation that President Obama thinks the military effort against ISIS is working just fine. He thinks the handling of the refugees is just fine. He thinks the background checks going on the refugees are working just fine. Even though, like, just last month, the FBI director was saying, look, there's no infrastructure in Syria for us to check this against. We have a lot of blank spaces in these sorts of things. It's not like we can get good answers from the Syrian regime about these people and who's got a criminal record and things like this. You know, I mean, if you can't figure out if somebody has a criminal record in Syria, wouldn't that leave you a little bit nervous? If you can't tell if they're a criminal, how do you tell if they're a terrorist unless you happen to be lucky enough to somehow catch the ISIS membership list, presuming they keep such things in one place, and you get the complete roster for them and you check the names against it and you manage to get them. Short of that, it's really hard to think how you can accurately check these people. The White House did a conference call with governors, and the governors walked away frustrated, not just Republicans. Jerry Brown said, look, at the very least, can we get a list? Like, apparently state governments don't get lists of these refugees, Greg.
Right.
And Jerry Brown's like, you know, it might really be helpful for our state police and our authorities if we could have access to those lists. And White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonnell said, yeah, no, we don't have a mechanism to share that information, and we don't think that's going to change anytime soon, and we don't see any reason to change. I mean, there's just this smugness and arrogance in this. And so here's the thing. Imagine if the Obama administration had said, you know what, we see people are really concerned about this. We're going to be really open about how the vetting process works. We're going to show the whole thing to all the American people to make them feel reassured. We're going to take input on how to improve this process. We're going to share information with the states. We're going to do everything we possibly can to address the concerns of these governors, these members of Congress, any American who's worried about this system. We're going to do what we can to show you the system is working well. And instead, the response has been, no, you're xenophobic and racist and you're a coward. And now Obama can't make any concessions because he's basically said that all of the opposition is driven by this malevolent dark argument. I mean, he's a really bad president, Greg. He's really bad at this because if you begin by attacking somebody else's motivations and, you know, peering into their soul and seeing darkness and everything that Obama does with all of his political opponents, you end up in a situation where there is no, like, you can't back down from that. You can't say, okay, I agreed to compromise with the racists. He's just terrible at this, Greg. And so I'm going to stop before I rant any further.
If only there were a mechanism where you could get people a list of names and where you're going to put them. What's it called? Email?
You'd have to get a printing press. You'd have to get hot lead and you'd have to put the little thing, you know, and print them off. Like, you know, Gutenberg Bibles don't just grow on trees, Greg.
I'm sure the Excel spreadsheet company would love to have your business. Anyway, all right, on to campus craziness for the crazy martini now. Washington Post version of the story, student protesters filled Princeton's historic Nassau Hall Wednesday afternoon, sitting in the university president's office and refusing to leave until their demands to improve the social and academic experiences of black students on campus are met, starting with an acknowledgement of famous alumnus Woodrow Wilson's racist legacy and the removal of his name from all buildings. They say that the group demanded that the name of Woodrow Wilson, the 28th U.S. president, a segregationist who some believe supported the ideas of the Ku Klux Klan, be removed from a residential college, from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy and International Affairs and any other buildings, and that his mural be scrubbed from the dining hall. And lest you think that, wow, these people actually see a racist who actually was a racist. But here are some of the other demands, which will sound pretty familiar given the other protests. At Princeton, the protest came on the same day university officials announced that the leaders of the residential colleges would change their traditional names, effective immediately from master to head of college. Protesters are also demanding cultural competency training for all faculty and staff, including the discussion of the true role of freedom of speech and freedom of intellectual thought in a way that does not reinforce anti-blackness and xenophobia. Then here comes the best part of all. The administration must acknowledge that our past was white-centered, white-focused, and plagued with white supremacist ideology, that Princeton was built for wealthy, white, cisgender Christian males, that everyone who does not fit that definition was not meant to be here, that our campus culture still tells people who don't align with that demographic that they still are not meant to be here. Jim, if they had just stopped with Wilson, this would have been rational.
I was just about to say, Greg, is it that first segment, we want to erase Woodrow Wilson from history. Greg, is it possible we've misjudged this movement? maybe there's some good here. There's some common ground to be reached. Now, actually, here's the thing. We're thinking more realistically. If you look at, you know, Woodrow Wilson's time as president of the United States, and my colleague Jonah Goldberg writes some fascinating stuff, things that are kind of easily forgotten by history,
in his book Liberal Fascism, that basically, you know, Woodrow Wilson believed that the purpose of government was to get us all marching in the same direction, going towards the same goal. Individual liberty and dissent, he was not a big fan of. And this is kind of some frightening stuff if you look back at this. I don't think that's really what the kids there are objecting to. And it'd be good if they actually study the Woodrow Wilson record there. But if they have looked at it enough to conclude, hey, he's not a good guy, attaboy, college. Okay, sorry. I guess I shouldn't say attaboy. Some of them are transgender, probably. Attagender, boy, you know, person, carbon-based life form. Ah, you can't even talk to these people. But interesting. It is a great irony and kind of fun to watch the left, you know, the snake begins biting its own tail and trying to devour itself. And look, if you actually ended up with a serious discussion of Woodrow Wilson and what the original progressive did to, did to steer this country, maybe some good can come out of this craziness on campus.
You would hope so. One last point of personal privilege. Tonight, this very evening, Thursday evening, Jim Garrity is among four distinguished young conservative journalists who will be the recipients of the prestigious Young Conservative Leadership Buckley Award. And all four journalists are very well deserving. But of course, Jim is the one we are most excited about getting this award. And so, Jim, I have to ask you, especially, it's been a very good year for you. You won the CPAC Conservative Journalist of the Year Award. So we might need to start calling you the Daniel Day-Lewis of conservative journalists. But the question is, are you more honored to win the Buckley Award as a National Review guy or to be considered a young journalist?
Oh, you put your finger on it, because they've had this award for like 5 or 6 years, and you shouldn't be like, oh, I really want to get one of those. You know, the whole thing of it's honored to be nominated. Lots of good folks over the last couple of years have been honored. I could be wrong. I don't think anybody who's a full-time contributor at National Review has been named for that, though. So that makes me feel pretty good. But also, look, this today happens to mark the 60th anniversary of National Review. I believe the first magazines were hitting the newsstands today, 60 years ago. So it's a special day. As the old saying goes, it's an honor to be nominated. This is a really great award, being honored with Lachlan Marquet, Kirsten Soltis Anderson, and Molly Hemingway, other great folks. But you're right. I believe they used to give this award to some young journalist between the age of, you know, young conservative between the age of 25 and 40. And this year I happen to notice the criteria is 25 and 45. So I would have made it under 40 just as is, but it is kind of nice. Like it's really honored to be recognized, and it's really an exceptional honor to be recognized and called young. So if you'll excuse me now, I got to go color my hair.
Well, congratulations again. It's a very, very well deserved, and we look forward to being back with you tomorrow. Perhaps we can hear your trophy somehow in the background.
it's a plaque, and I'll just hold it up to the microphone so everyone can see it. See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.